You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 14th of January 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
On this vote, the ayes are 232, the nays are 197. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
Donald Trump continues to make history, but perhaps not in the way he imagined. In Italy, 350 members of a mafia family go on trial. We'll look at what that's likely to achieve. Then...
Taking on General Museveni is taking on the Uganda police force, the Uganda military, the Bank of Uganda. All institutions of state have been deployed against us.
That's the voice of Ugandan opposition candidate Bobi Wine. The country votes today in an election which has been branded in advance to be neither free nor fair as the opposition comes under increasing pressure from the ruling party. We'll follow the long-standing row between Boeing and Airbus and the spat over tariffs on wine. We'll get the latest fashion news and flick through the papers before we ask our tech expert, Josh Coles, to tell us about Poland's social media law and regulation of the industry. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. A World Health Organization team has arrived in the Chinese city of Wuhan to start its investigation into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. South Korea's Supreme Court has upheld a 20-year jail term for former President Park Geun-hye, who was found guilty of abuse of power and of coercion. And archaeologists have found the world's oldest known animal cave painting in Indonesia. It's believed the picture of a wild pig was drawn almost 46,000 years ago. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, we begin in the US, where Donald Trump has become the first president to be impeached twice. 10 Republicans crossed the floor to vote that Trump should face the charge of incitement of insurrection following his incitement of a mob attack on the Capitol exactly a week before. Thomas Lewis is Monocle 24's Toronto bureau chief and he's our US political correspondent. Thomas, you've been following the US election for Monocle from the start. Was this outcome one you ever imagined?
Well, after what happened, Georgina, last week, I suppose there are many of us who felt that this was inevitable. But it is a coda to a presidency that is perhaps as remarkable as that presidency itself. I think when you look at the proceedings that took place in the US House of Representatives yesterday, when you look at the magnitude of impeaching a president and how grave an act politically that is, it happened all very quickly. The debates took place for a few hours, and then the vote began, and it was sort of concluded by, I think, around 4:30 p.m. in the afternoon local time in Washington. I think what we did hear from both sides are themes that will continue now as we look towards a Senate trial. Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, has said that he won't reconvene Congress before the 19th of January when it is due to sit once again. So we are likely to see this trial now take place in the first opening act, if you like, of Joe Biden's presidency. But I think the themes of trying to heal divisions, which is a big refrain that lots of the Republican members of Congress said yesterday in their speeches who opposed impeaching the president, but also that undoubtedly a crime against the nation had been committed here. That was the big line from the Democrats and also the 10 Republicans that voted with them to impeach President Trump for a second time. And he is, of course, now, as you mentioned, Georgina, the first president in US history to have been impeached twice.
And how key was Mitch McConnell's decision to not vote against this in the first instance?
I think it was absolutely crucial that the House Republicans, that the whips were told that they wouldn't be forcing their members to oppose the Democrats' impeachment motion. I think that really was very important. I think you will have seen, however, that there were lots of Republican figures who calculated that, looking at their own constituency, the constituencies, the parts of the country that they represent, that voted them into office in the first place, that opposing the idea of impeachment and therefore perhaps not distancing themselves entirely from Donald Trump as large other numbers of the elected offices in the United States, in Washington D.C., have done, then that perhaps is kind of interesting to see how this mood now sort of shifts over the months to come in terms of how the Republican Party wants to recast itself, if you like, or not, after the chaos of last Wednesday, but also after an unprecedented presidency, if you like, in Donald Trump's term in the White House.
Thomas, thank you very much. Well, let's turn now to Scott Lucas, who's a regular US politics commentator here on Monocle 24 and an adjunct professor at the Clinton Institute at University College Dublin. Scott, as we hear, this won't go before the Senate before at least the 19th. How then is the trial likely to unfold?
Well, in fact, Georgina, we've got a development in that the trial will not proceed even on the 19th. The leading Senate Republican, Mitch McConnell, made it clear yesterday that there will be no proceedings before Joe Biden is inaugurated on the 20th of January. However, what is significant is that McConnell did say through his office that he believes Trump has committed impeachable offenses. That means there certainly will be a trial after January 20th, because you can try a federal official after he's left office and convict him. The question will then be this. You'll have the hearings. You'll have the vote on the floor of the Senate. Now, you need a two-thirds vote to convict. The Senate will be split 50-50, 50 Democrats, 50 Republicans. Will 17 Republicans join the Democrats to convict Donald Trump? I think up to 48 hours ago, we almost certainly would have said no. However, McConnell's indication, very pointed indication, that he will consider conviction could lead a group of Republicans to follow him. And that would raise the prospect that Donald Trump would be convicted. Why is that significant? It means that Trump would lose his privileges as a former president. He would lose a very lucrative pension of more than $200,000 a year. And perhaps most crucially, the Senate could then vote to say that Donald Trump cannot run for president in 2024.
And who will represent him legally? I mean, there are reports that he's fallen out with his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. He's refusing to pay his fees.
Well, interestingly enough, when I spoke yesterday in response to Alan Dershowitz, the celebrity lawyer trying to deal with his, let's say, misrepresentations of the legal and political position, it is that same Alan Dershowitz who, while pushing Trump, trying to defend him across media, is being touted as being the person that the Trump team want to lead the defense in the Senate.
And will Dershowitz take it on?
Hasn't said yet. I mean, he also was, his name was in the box last January, when you might remember that Donald Trump was tried on the impeachment charge of getting Ukraine or pressuring Ukraine to smear Joe Biden. But at that point, Dershowitz didn't take a formal role. Instead, he advised informally and, of course, continued to do his media role, explaining that Donald Trump, of course, did absolutely nothing wrong whatsoever.
Yeah. Now, Thomas was saying, of course, that we are looking to the future of the GOP and wondering how this is all going to line up. You have, basically, as far as I can see it, Cheney and Jordan are emerging as leaders of a roughly anti and pro-Trump faction. And Kevin McCarthy is somewhere maybe in the middle.
Well, I think let's go wide on this. First of all, Georgina, beyond the names, this is the most serious position for the Republicans, I think, since the 1930s, when they were absolutely hammered by the Democrats and Franklin Roosevelt during the Depression. This party is now split, perhaps irretrievably split between two factions. You have the establishment Republicans, Mitch McConnell in the Senate. You've mentioned Liz Cheney, who was the first House representative to come out for impeachment. But then you have the Trumpist. Remember that at least six of those senators and at least 138 representatives, almost 70% of the Republicans in the House, voted to back Donald Trump and to object to President-elect Biden after last Wednesday's violence. Now, Jim Jordan, who is pretty much like an attack dog on behalf of Trump, is one of those Trumpists, but there are others who will vie to be the leading, basically, Trumpist in the House. I'm not sure Kevin McCarthy can hold the line between the two factions. Mitch McConnell, who's an even better politician, even he will struggle to do so, which I think explains, to take this all the way back around to the top, why Mitch McConnell, who protected Trump for almost 4 years, who made sure that he was not convicted last year over the Ukraine scandal, has come out and said, yes, perhaps we need to make sure that this president is accountable for what he's done in the past week.
Mm. Scott, I wonder if there's a danger of this just making Trump a martyr, of making his cause even more important to his supporters, who we have seen are capable of intense violence.
Look, whatever happens, Georgina, Donald Trump's going to play the victim. I mean, it's the paradox that one of the most bullying, aggressive presidents, perhaps the most bullying president in U.S. history, will say, oh, look at me. I'm a victim of the fake news media. I'm a victim of the Democrats. I'm a victim of the courts. I'm a victim. Look, he's going to do that, whatever. I'm just going to put this to you bluntly. There was an attempt last week to prevent Joe Biden from becoming president of the United States that was instigated by Donald Trump. Those people who were instigated by Donald Trump, for the first time in American history, a group of Americans attacked their own Capitol building. Five people died, and that group, now according to the FBI and Capitol Police, were intent on killing others. If you do not hold Donald Trump accountable for his role in that, then you effectively have set aside American democracy and American security for your worry, oh, how might he react on social media if he can get back on social media to a possible impeachment trial.
Scott, thank you very much for that very powerful analysis. That's Scott Lucas there. And of course, we're going to have more coverage across the day and on The Briefing, live from midday London time here on Monocle 24. Yesterday saw the start of Italy's largest mafia trial in more than 30 years, as 350 members of the 'Ndrangheta worldwide crime syndicate faced a judge in Calabria to answer charges going back decades. Anna Sergi is a senior lecturer in criminology at the University of Essex, currently in Calabria. Anna, can you tell us more about this famous mafia family?
This one specific clan and their allies, this specific family, the Mancuso clan, is quite a well-known family in the area. They are drug traffickers. They have been involved in a series of violent acts in the past. But they are overall a new family, if new means 40 years old. So they are not the most historic family in the 'Ndrangheta. So they've been a bit of a wild and unpredictable in the mafia sense. Specifically, the guy who is on trial today, the guy who is known as the Supreme or the Uncle, with Luigi Mancuso, is the last of 11 brothers and is facing charges also because of his nephew, who is going to testify against him. So there is a little bit of a difficult moment in the family overall. As you can imagine, 11 brothers have a lot of relatives, and the fact that one of them has turned against another member of the family is not sitting down very well with the rest.
Now, it's not the first time that there's been a maxi trial in Italy. How significant is this one?
I would say not as significant as it may sound. I mean, the numbers are certainly very high. We are talking about one of the biggest Italian trials ever. However, this is a specific choice. It's not meant to be this way just because. So this is a choice that the prosecutor team made in order to get the attention on the trial, to tell the state, look, we need money, we need resources. This is not a fight we can win. So there is a specific choice behind this trial. In terms of significance, this trial doesn't tell us anything new, apart from obviously technicalities and relationship and networks that it has uncovered. But in terms of the ways in which the mafia works, it has confirmed certain things, which is great to have confirmed. And it has enlightened certain relationships across the Masonic lodges, deviated Masonic lodges, politicians and mafia figures, which we suspected but had not been brought to the forefront. In the long term, I don't think this is going to matter that much for the 'Ndrangheta, at least.
How then involved are the various arms of the Italian government in these crimes?
That depends on the region and on the people. Most of the time, thank God, it's an individual basis occurrence. So you have the one politician who decides that it's a great idea to exchange services and benefits with the mafia figure. Sometimes it's a personal relationship, like the one in this case, where the member of the parliament was the lawyer of one of the lawyers of Luigi Mancuso. So that's how the relationship began, even if he was then elected member of parliament. Most of the time, politicians don't really know who they, how can I put it? In certain places, like in Calabria, politicians don't often know who they are talking to, both in terms of mafia and in terms of people who are involved with mafia figures. So it's very dense in terms of blurred lines. We call it the gray area. However, it's not always the same and not everywhere in Italy. So most of the time, it's a very fine line between what people believe it's mafia infiltration and what it actually is mafia infiltration. It's always about personal responsibility most of the time.
Given the supposed involvement of key state figures, though, and the intense violence surrounding this family, how have the investigations taken place?
The investigation is not a new one, so it covers about 10 years of investigations. So it brings them all together under what came to fruition since 2016, 2017. Italian anti-mafia investigation lasts for at least 2 years at a time. They can be extended if there are new elements, so they can be pretty long. As I said, this specific family has been under trial for ever. So they constantly go in and out of jail. The same Luigi Mancuso has been in jail for 19 years, the last time he was convicted. So they are not new to the game. Investigations are complicated, and they usually span from network analysis to intercepted materials, surveillance. There is quite a lot of surveillance going on, both physical surveillance and electronic one. And obviously, most of what has been uncovered remains through communication. And the fact that Italians, not just Italians, but obviously for the Italians, has made a massive difference, can intercept encrypted communication, WhatsApp messaging, for example, that has made things a lot easier in the past couple of years.
So what impact will this have? I mean, what does the state, given its likely complicity, hope to gain by this case? Can it shut the family down?
Yeah, no, that's not happening. I mean, as I said already, Luigi Mancuso was in jail for 19 years and he was still the boss for the whole of the 19 years. So prison does not, prison does the opposite effect. It elevates the mafia member to a higher status. So to go to prison doesn't actually mean that you are out of the game. The family is very strong in the sense that they dominate the cocaine trade in Calabria, from Calabria, sorry, to the rest of the world. They are number one at the table of drug traffickers. So it's really difficult to eradicate something like that just with a trial. And it's about the state figures. As I said, they are individuals, single individuals. We're not talking about systemic corruption here in this specific case, at least. We are talking about institutions, though, like some of the Freemasons' deviated lodges. And obviously, there is something more there. But I don't think it will be tackled in this trial. This trial is about punishment. It's not about fixing or preventing things for the future.
Anna, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Anna Sergi.
Now, still to come in the programme, we'll get the latest from the ground in Uganda, where citizens are going to the polls today. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Now, on Tuesday, the United States slapped an additional 25% tariff on French wines. It's the latest move in a 15-year-old dispute over EU subsidies to Airbus and Boeing. Well, Hossack Lee Makiyama is the director of the European Centre for International Political Economy and joins me on the, I hope, slightly better line now. Hossack, can you give us the background to this spat?
Well, Georgina, the case between Airbus and the counter case from Boeing has actually been going on since 2005. It's actually one of the oldest trade disputes we have ongoing, and it has reached across 6 US presidential terms and 4 EU commissions. And well, it doesn't seem it's coming to a conclusion actually for a further few more years. And in the latest step, United States have complained over the EU non-compliance of the recent WTO rulings, and therefore has gone ahead and put punitive tariffs in addition to a number of tariffs that it has already put on over this dispute. And as you very well point out, we have a number of key export products coming from both Germany and France, but also the UK, and most of all on Airbus parts that is being shipped to Alabama, where actually Airbus assembles some of its planes that are designated for the US market.
And where does Boeing come into this then?
Well, the thing is that Boeing has launched this case first in 2005. And as far as EU is concerned, well, both sides are actually accusing each other of receiving illegal state support, but in different ways. So in other words, basically both are throwing rocks in glass houses. Mm. So as we're saying, Boeing, which is a key strategic asset for the United States, is of course receiving subsidies and cross subsidies in various forms, and it's also a very important military supplier.
Yeah. Do you think that this could have been handled better? I mean, the transatlantic relationship on trade has always been characterized by fierce competition and litigation, even under Obama.
Yes, indeed. Few people actually may take notice of this, but the EU-US relationship has always been a little bit like siblings. They stab each other in the back whenever they can, and it is a fierce competition for market shares in third markets, and this is not the only litigation they have between them. We have also in parallel a US planned duties against LVMH and Hermès and other fashion brands over the digital taxes that France has imposed or is planning also imposing in other EU countries against US online platforms. So this tit for tat has been going on despite which party that happens to be in power in the United States. This is not a Trump thing. It goes much further back than that.
And do you think it could change under Biden?
Absolutely not. As we said, the aerospace industry is a national interest that rises above any bipartisan divide. And also some of the subsidies that Boeing is receiving is actually a state-level support. It's not a federal support. So unless you see Washington State changing its mind around taxation, you will never see a full compliance of this case. So the best outcome would have been actually that the both sides just sat down and negotiated from day one, because they neither side have actually any ideas of giving up their support for Airbus and Boeing.
And so is anybody actually benefiting from this?
Well, trade lawyers, because they have racked up tens and hundreds of thousands of billable hours. And there's actually a room in Geneva in the World Trade Organization that stores all the correspondence coming from trade lawyers. And it's actually perhaps Geneva's most interesting tourist attraction.
Hossett, thank you very much indeed. That's Hossett Lee Makiyama. And here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. As we heard earlier, Donald Trump has become the first US president to be impeached twice. The US House of Representatives voted to impeach Trump for incitement of insurrection after last week's riot at the Capitol. A World Health Organization team has arrived in the Chinese city of Wuhan to start its investigation into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. The investigation by the team of 10 scientists is trying to find out how the virus jumped to humans from animals so that another pandemic can be avoided in the future. South Korea's Supreme Court has upheld a 20-year jail term for former President Park Geun-hye, who was found guilty of abuse of power and coercion. The end of the legal process clears the way for a presidential pardon, which her supporters have called for. Park took office in 2013 as South Korea's first woman president and became the country's first democratically elected leader to be thrown out of office. And archaeologists have found the world's oldest known animal cave painting in Indonesia. It's believed the picture of a wild pig was drawn almost 46,000 years ago and provides the earliest evidence of human settlement in the region. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Today, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, who's enjoyed strong Western backing for 35 years and tens of billions of dollars in military and financial assistance, will contest his sixth term in office. His main presidential challenger is the musician and legislator, the Honourable Robert Kaya Gulani MP, better known as Bobby Wine, as well as another opposition candidate, Patrick Amuriat. Both have been repeatedly arrested by security forces and scores, perhaps hundreds, of their supporters have been tortured and killed. Thousands of other opposition supporters are detained, many without access to lawyers, doctors or their families. Well, Phil Clark is a professor of international politics at SOAS at the University of London. He's visiting the region and he joins us now. Phil, does anyone expect these elections to be free or fair?
I don't think anybody expects this to be a fair election. Georgina, I'm here in Kigali in Rwanda, now keeping a close eye on what's happening just across the border in Uganda. The scene in Kampala, I was speaking to some friends there this morning, is that there are armoured cars and police all over the town. It's exactly the same in northern Uganda. There's a real atmosphere of pressure and fear about what might happen today. And of course, the story over the last 3 or 4 weeks has been the constant harassment of Bobby Wine and his supporters at almost every campaign rally, a really systematic attempt by Museveni's government to try to disrupt the opposition campaign. So I don't think anybody in Uganda really believes that this is going to be a free and fair election today.
And have there been and are there any foreign observers?
In the last few days, is that the government has been blocking a lot of foreign election observers. In fact, a couple of days ago, the US election team pulled out of their observation mission because several of their members had had their accreditation refused. So this is the kind of thing that we've seen Museveni's government do in the past, not only harassing the political opposition, but also making it very difficult for regional and foreign monitors to observe the election. So I think that only increases the concern that this is not going to be a free election today.
Now, Museveni says that Bobby Wine is only supported by foreign homosexuals, but it does seem that Wine has huge support. I see that his Twitter following leapt by about 1 million people over the last couple of days.
That's right. I don't think that Bobby Wine can get anywhere near winning this election today because it's really been rigged completely against him. But his campaign really does signify a generational shift in Ugandan politics. This is the first time that any serious challenger to Museveni has run without some liberation credentials. Bobby Wine isn't connected to the Bush War. He's not connected to the liberation movement. He brings a very different brand of politics. And in particular, he's very much carrying the message of many young Ugandans Ugandans who are fed up with the NRM, the ruling party. They're fed up with Museveni, who, of course, has been in power for 35 years. And there's a real desire for change, a real desire to move beyond a very corrupt, very inept government. Bobby Wine, I think, very much represents this younger generation's voice. And I think the sense in Uganda today is that Bobby Wine won't win this election because it's been so heavily rigged against him, but that this may build a foundation for him and other younger leaders to run again in 5 years' time, that perhaps it's 2026 when we might start to see serious political change in Uganda, but Bobby Wine definitely signifies something very different happening in Ugandan politics at the moment.
Now, there's been a huge campaign backed by many international musicians calling for free and fair elections, but has there been much pressure from international governments?
There hasn't been very much systematic pressure brought to bear here. And I think in many respects, this is the connection between the Ugandan election and what's going on in the US at the moment. In the past, it's been the likes of the United States that have put pressure on Museveni and have called for free and fair elections. But of course, it's very difficult for the US to do that at the moment, that they don't really have a sense of moral legitimacy because of everything that the world has been watching happening in Washington in the last few days. And so I think in many respects that has emboldened Museveni, that there's a real sense that the international community can't legitimately crack down on Uganda but because they themselves have lost the moral high ground in that sense. And also I think there is a little bit of international fatigue with Ugandan politics, a real sense that in the past any form of pressure really has not changed the way that Museveni has conducted everyday politics and conducted these elections. And so we haven't seen the kind of vociferous international outcry over the holding of these elections, which we might have seen in the past. So yes, the international pressure has been a lot less this time around.
Now, we know that there's already been violence and members of the opposition have been attacked. Do you expect more violence today?
I think the concern is going to be perhaps not so much today. It's going to be when the results of the election are announced, probably in the next 24 to 48 hours. The noise is coming out of Bobby Wine's campaign, and I've been speaking to some people inside his campaign in the last few days, is that they are preparing themselves for a heavily rigged result.
Many thanks to Phil Clark there from SOAS University. Continue now with today's newspapers, and joining me down the line is Simon Brook, a journalist and communications consultant. Good morning to you, Simon.
Good morning.
Business travel, is it about to recover?
That is a good question. Yes, it's a question that the Financial Times is exploring today with its big read. It points out that the sector lost about $710 billion of revenue during the pandemic. And the question it's asking, yes, exactly, will hotel and airlines ever claw it back? The paper points out that Zoom has enjoyed a 485% increase year on year, which is great news for Zoom, of course, but not so good for the airlines and the hotels. The paper looks at the fact that the feeling is that leisure travel may bounce back, but the question, will business travel? Does that matter? Well, apparently it represents, according to the Financial Times, about 75% of airlines revenue on some international flights. And there are conflicting predictions. Jeffrey Goh, chief executive of Star Alliance, which is the world's biggest airline group, is quoted saying that there will be structural change which could leave the sector about 30% smaller. Other people suggesting that it will sort of bounce back more effectively. But very difficult to predict, really.
Absolutely. Let's move on to the Daily Telegraph, talking about tax cuts.
Yeah, this is a question for the government and for the right, and actually, of course, for right of centre parties throughout the world, really. Alistair Heath, who is the editor actually of the Sunday Telegraph, but very much a free marketeer, is looking at the choice facing the Conservative Party, the Conservative government, and he is looking at a question about whether they will return to the kind of tax cutting deregulation agenda that he and many on the right are very keen on? Or will they use the opportunity, if you like, of COVID and the need to ramp up the economy again to ramp up taxes as well? And the tax he particularly focuses on is stamp duty. That's the money that the tax that people have to pay when they buy and sell a new house, of course. And he's suggesting that the Tories would do really badly, sort of philosophically, but also practically, if they were to scrap their previously stated goal to cut the tax. And he points out that this is one of the things that stops people moving house, that stops that kind of social mobility. So, yeah, a big question for the government here in the UK and for right of centre governments around the world.
Because it does signal then that they're becoming more of a social democratic party if they do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a question that will, as I say, a lot of people will be asking, because I suppose really that one of the points inherent in the piece, he doesn't actually say it, is that obviously Boris Johnson is known not to be to have a sort of political ideology. So I think a lot in the Tory party will be looking and trying to work out which side he goes to. Will he be more of a sort of the soft return to the sort of the Ted Heath party of the 1970s, or will it be more of the sort of Margaret Thatcher party that we saw, which was very much giving people back their own money and allowing them to spend it? But given there are such, you know, the economy is obviously in such a difficult situation after COVID, and there are such demands from both sides, really, it'll be interesting to see which side the Johnson government comes down on.
Well, as you say, Johnson doesn't appear to have a particular political ideology, which in itself is extraordinary. The Times picks up on that in a way, talking about how he has to set out a vision as well as master the detail.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was interesting here, two comment pieces, this second one by Ian Martin in the Times, as you say, which really show what a sort of critical juncture the government is at. And Ian Martin, he's arguing, another sort of right of centre columnist, is arguing the number 10 team has been rebuilt, and now the Prime Minister needs to prove that he can master the detail as well as set out a vision. So obviously, Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister's maverick advisor, was sacked a few months ago. And there have been reports in the media ever since of a more sort of serious heavyweight team, if you like, a bit replacing him. So, yes, this again, just like the tax cut piece, looking at whether Johnson will be able to assemble the kind of team that can master the detail and give some sort of governmental authority and weight to his administration, if you like, in these, you know, in these difficult times ahead.
And in terms of his team, I mean, up until now, we've looked at him really gathering Brexiteers close to him. Now that is done and dusted, so to speak, or almost, is that still important, or could the pool from which he could choose become wider?
Well, there's two things here, isn't there, really? Yes, exactly. I mean, there is there's the cabinet, and it's been widely reported that there are many members of the cabinet whose main qualification for the job is not their competence, but just their loyalty as Brexit supporters. Now that the deal has been passed, there is a lot of speculation about whether he might then decide that he no longer needs the support of people like Priti Patel and Gavin Williamson, ministers who have been criticised, and then perhaps he could eject them, if you like. The other question is also about his own team around number 10. A new chief of staff, Dan Rosenfield, appointed late last year, who it's expected will provide some kind of order and stability to the number 10 team post Cummings. So it'll be interesting to see what he does to the cabinet, but also what the Prime Minister does for his own team at number 10. And I think it's actually the latter that's probably going to be more important.
Yeah, absolutely. Finally, let's look at a surprise hit on television.
I love this. This is really one of those, if you want, the sort of one in the eye for the culture snobs. So, yeah, The Guardian is looking at Death in Paradise, which is which, as the paper says, has quietly become one of TV's biggest hits. You know it. It's the sort of the murder mystery, the whodunit on a Caribbean island, sort of Agatha Christie, Death Under the Sun. But for 10 series now, I think it is amazingly successful. Criticised by the critics, as I say, but the paper points out, The Guardian points out, that the show has been licensed to more than 230 territories, and it's often the best performing drama on the TV. It's actually some of its episodes reaching 9 million viewers, which in these days of fragmented viewership is pretty amazing. Yes, and just looking, a celebration really of this wonderful feel-good show. I've only seen one episode, but I quite liked it, actually, I have to say. I'm going to become a fan, I think.
I know a couple of members of the cast, and they tell me that it's one of the most sought-after jobs in acting, particularly, and it revolves for that reason. So different people go out there to film, and everybody gets a little shot at having their time on a Caribbean island.
Exactly. I mean, I think that is probably, especially on a grey, rainy day in London, it is a wonderful escape, isn't it? One of the other things that the paper is looking at or reports on is that where it says that when the creator, Robert Thorogood, finally came up with the show, he was 35 years old. He'd been a screenwriter with no credits for 15 years. He'd basically been a failure. Nothing had even made it to pilot. He was being supported financially by his wife. But now finally he got this success. So it occurs to me, I mean, why isn't somebody writing the story behind Death in Paradise? It's a wonderful sort of feel-good story in itself, isn't it?
Absolutely. Simon, thanks for joining us. That was Simon Brooke. And this is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
This is The Globalist with me, Georgina Godwin, and it's time to talk fashion with the retail analyst Rebecca Tay. Hello to you, Rebecca.
Hi, Georgina.
So we are going to start off looking at a major fashion brand which has deleted its social media accounts. Do we know why?
You know what? There's so much speculation as to why. So it's Bottega Veneta, as you said, one of the biggest brands of the moment. And it's interesting because they have 2.5 million followers, so it's not just a small account. They deleted their Facebook, their Twitter, and I think most visibly to everyone in fashion, their Instagram account. So some people are saying, you know, maybe it's a marketing stunt. Maybe they're sort of preparing to launch their spring collection, doing sort of what some artists have done just before they drop a new album. Or maybe it's just sort of their new version of luxury. You know, Bottega was always kind of one of those brands that was sort of a more of a stealth luxury, very sort of unbranded, no logos anywhere. And its new artistic director, Daniel Lee, is sort of known within the industry for liking this kind of quieter version of luxury. Mm. So some people are also saying maybe it's just kind of going back to a sort of an older version of luxury where it's a little bit quieter, basically.
Although there has been, I mean, this amazing political lashback at social media. I see that for instance, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, that's Meghan Markle, and Prince Harry, have deleted their accounts too.
Yes, you know, it's kind of a funny thing because social media has given access to everybody, to everyone that they follow, every fashion brand, every celebrity. And then on the other hand, a lot of people, as you said, the royals, these major fashion brands are sort of maybe contemplating whether or not it's actually what they wanted in the first place, sort of reconsidering whether the effect is what they wanted.
I mean, and does it make it more exclusive if you don't have a social media presence?
I think for Bottega, it could. There's a lot of analysts that are also saying that maybe this will be sort of a new wave of other brands that will follow suit. I think there's a lot of noise on social media, especially on Instagram, where fashion is probably the most prevalent. So in a way, I think I would say that does kind of make it more exclusive, as you say.
Yeah. Right. Let's have a look at Prada and the new collection.
Yeah, so this was very interesting, actually. So this happened the day after Bottega deleted their Instagram. And they basically released their new collection, but sort of rather than having traditional lookbook images or models in their campaign, they basically said that there was no photographer, and they put a bunch of questions. So they're all kind of these existential questions all over their ads, which are quite interesting, and they're sort of inviting people to answer the questions on their website. But there's been a lot of kind of jokes poking fun at the questions. So, for example, one of them is, what utopia do you strive for? And of course, the internet has sort of, you know, kind of taken, starting to take this to the next level.
Yeah, absolutely. Rebecca, what is GOP Core?
So GOP Core stands for good old raisins and peanuts. So it's kind of basically the idea that it's, you know, the snacks that you would bring with you on a big hike or if you were going rambling across the countryside. It tends to be a little bit more of a trend. It's a fashion trend, but it tends to be a little bit more relevant to men's fashion, but it is kind of taking off in women's fashion as well. And it's basically just the idea that North Face jackets and puffer jackets, kind of hiking boots have become very fashionable again, I think in the last year or so.
Excellent. I'd love that. Raisins. What was it? Something and raisins.
Good old raisins and peanuts.
Good old raisins and peanuts. Right. Yes. LVMH has replaced the senior team at Tiffany. Tell us what's behind this.
So this is going on, been going on for ages and ages. So LVMH has finally acquired Tiffany. The deal finally was finished and finalized. They finally acquired the company for $15.8 billion. So it's about just under 12 billion pounds. And kind of as to be expected with a takeover of this size, they've gone and replaced the entire senior team. So they have a new CEO that's coming in who was actually previously at the company. They have announced that the artistic director will be leaving. So whether or not we'll see an immediate shift in the direction that the designs, you know, the jewelry and things like that will be seen. As a chief brand officer that actually joined quite recently, she'll be leaving as well. And their CFO was also ousted. So this is all kind of taking place, they say, sort of in the end of January or after a short transition period. But I think it's the first of many changes that we'll see at Tiffany.
And what does it mean for the brand?
I think, you know, the acquisition was really there to kind of help the brand take advantage of opportunity in China. So whether or not these people are better positioned or better, you know, have more expertise in that area or kind of more knowledgeable, I suppose, into how to kind of take Tiffany to the next level. Well, I think that's what we're going to see in the next little while.
Yeah. Finally, I want to look at mushroom-based leather.
Yes. So mushroom-based leather is one of those interesting things. It's probably the most kind of high potential natural fabric, as you can say. So, you know, brands like Stella McCartney have long been interested in and have been kind of investing in research. But Adidas is actually the latest brand to say that they're going to be using mushroom leather. So it's actually called mycelium or mycelium, which is basically the webbed part of a fungus. And it's basically how they turn fungus into kind of a leather-like material.
And what does it look like? I mean, is it convincing?
You know, I haven't actually felt it myself. I haven't touched it. People do say it is quite convincing. It's waterproof. It's heat resistant. So it does have a lot of unique properties that make it longer lasting as well. And obviously, it's a little bit more sustainable or environmentally friendly than traditional animal-based leathers. It does have a slight stretch to it, I believe, which gives it that kind of texture that you're looking, that you do look for. But I haven't actually felt it myself. But people do say that it is quite quite leather-like, I guess you could say.
Excellent. Rebecca, thanks very much indeed. That's Rebecca Tay, and this is The Globalist. Of Donald Trump from various social media sites has reinvigorated the conversation about the power of social media around the world, including in Poland, where the Justice Ministry is fighting back by preparing legislation to ban bans. Josh Coles is a researcher at the University of Oxford's Internet Institute and joins me on the line now. Josh, Poland isn't alone amongst authoritarian states wanting to crack down on freedom of speech online. Can you tell me more about this specific legislation? What is Poland pushing for?
Yes, that's right. Poland's plan is to prevent platforms like Facebook and Twitter from removing users and banning their posts.
on the basis of those users breaking the terms of service of and the kind of community standards of those sites. And as you say, this is in the vein of similar attempts by authoritarian governments around the world, whether through legislation or just through rhetoric, to demonize social media. Ironically, in many cases, the very social media who helped them to get elected in the first place. You know, we see the sort of populist figures like Donald Trump and Duterte in the Philippines as examples of people who really harness the power of social media as outsiders and insurgents. And once they made it into the presidential palaces, became very disaffected with how social media were handling their communications.
Mm. I mean, does this point to a wider tension about who is best placed to decide what can be said online? Who gets to legislate?
I think it does. And I think we're now very much into the phase of pick your poison when it comes to deciding who gets to decide, if you like. If you're a social media user, it depends a lot on where you are in the world, what platform you're using. But either way, it seems at the moment like you face the decision, very difficult decision between whether you'd want the social media elite to decide that, often very out of touch with their own, of course, perspectives and ideologies and so on, or whether you trust your own government to do so instead. And as we've seen, at least the leaders of some of those governments, including those long considered democratic, have been really raising the spectre of more authoritarian approaches to handling social media governance. Now, of course, Trump is on the way out. But I do think his successor, Joe Biden, still has difficult decisions to make in terms of how to grapple with these competing interests among social media companies and how to keep the internet both safe and free.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what is the solution? How can governments control the online sphere more as it becomes a legitimate political space? And should they, in fact, be trying to do that?
Well, that is the multi-billion-dollar question. And I think it's one that we're going to have to think about very carefully in the months and years to come, although, of course, we don't really have too much time to waste, given how present these dangers are at the moment. I think there's a few different approaches that could be taken. I think at root, there's a more fundamental problem here, even than questions of freedom of speech and online safety. And that's the question of incentives and sort of profit motive of the companies involved and their business models. You know, really, as we've seen to devastating effect over the last decade or so, social media companies are driven above all else by profit, and profit is achieved by serving ads, relevant ads to users in most cases. And that really does transform how these services are built, because it means that user retention is the most important thing. And it's often those pieces of content that get our attention, which are shocking or outrageous or in other ways disturbing. And that can, I think, contribute to a climate where people go online and instead of being calmed or informed, are actually angered and sometimes radicalized. And we're seeing the effects of that. Yeah. So I think there's a broad range of options that could be taken, many of which will have to be considered.
We were just in our fashion roundup looking at the luxury fashion brand Bottega Veneta, who have deleted all of their social media accounts. We also made reference to the fact that Meghan Markle and Prince Harry have done the same. Is this about to become the new exclusivity, not having a social media account? Does that somehow possibly make you more desirable?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Prince Harry and Meghan Markle because, you know, of course, Prince Harry was born into the role of a celebrity, if you like. And I think if we did return to that exclusivity approach to celebrity and branding, then it really would favour the incumbents in a way that the incumbents used to be favoured 10 or 20 years ago, before you had upstarts like Justin Bieber on YouTube or others like that who were able to kind of leverage the online sphere to really propel them as celebrities online and offline. So I think it would be an interesting shift towards those who already have the attention back to that kind of pre-internet days when that's how the world of celebrity and attention worked. So I think it would change the game. I don't know whether being off all social media for good is necessarily going to help communicate, just because, you know, at the end of the day, we still have all these devices in our hands, and that's what we spend so much of our time looking at and reading. So it would be an interesting business decision, I think. But curious to see how that turns out for those brands.
Absolutely. And just very, very quickly, Josh, we started with Donald Trump. Let's end with him too. Without his social media megaphone, is he finished?
Without his current social media megaphones, yes. I think that will certainly prevent him getting in touch with the supporters, particularly when the organs of the White House aren't there to spread his words. The question is whether he sets up his own one,
yeah,
and whether that will be subject to its own rules as well.
Josh, thank you very much indeed. And that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Marcus Hippie, Paige Reynolds, Carlotta Ribello and Daniel Bache. Our researcher was Charlie Filmer-Court and our studio manager was Nora Hull, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. I'll be with you for the Continental Shift for the next 3 or 4 hours. And then the briefing is live at midday. Today, it's coming from our studios in Zurich and it'll be presented by Tyler Brulé. The Globalist will return at the same time tomorrow with Emma Nelson in the presenter's chair. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.